You're listening to The Read Out, one development leader, their big idea, and how it can shape the future of Australian development assistance. Hosted by Lab CEO, Bridie Rice.
At any point in time, Australia has around $32 billion invested globally through programs that promote sustainable economic growth and prosperity. Now, you know the deal. We're talking about everything from sophisticated programs helping Fiji establish its social protection systems and combating human trafficking in the Mekong, through to things like supporting humanitarian disaster response, helping get kids into schools, helping elections run fairly, and everything in between. But beyond all the Canberra talk about the budget is the real work of getting on with this job. Now, once Canberra or Australia's missions overseas have decided what they will fund, it must then work with implementing partners to deliver those projects in country. We're talking commercial contractors, NGOs, and local organisations that are the true boots on the ground, leading the implementation of these development initiatives. Now, on the one hand, donor and implementing partner relationships can be incredibly effective. They achieve high-quality results, they minimise the double handling and financial waste, and these are partnerships that are responding directly to in-country needs. Development organisations provide the essential expertise on the ground that makes Australian government funding well-managed and achieving results. But on the other hand, this donor-implementer relationship is a complex and sometimes fraught one, with implementation partners striving to maintain the social license to operate in the communities where they work, whilst at the same time managing the requirements of a donor like Australia. So this week on The Lab's Intel, and that's our fortnightly blog where we take one live policy question and seek three short, sharp answers, we asked, what is the secret to a successful donor-implementer relationship? Now, Matt Tinkler, CEO of Save the Children, is one of these experts, and I'm lucky enough to have him here with me today. Now, Matt's not short of some ticker, and nor is Save the Children, so it won't be a surprise to you that he had a bit to say on the intel. Matt, great to have you here.
Great to be with you, Brody.
Matt, what was a moment that first sprung to mind when we asked you, what is the secret to a successful donor-implementer relationship?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. And what immediately sprung to mind for me were two real life examples of the best and worst of that relationship. So the worst, and it's a very recent example that I had come over my desk, where essentially an old lawyer friend of mine had been contacted indirectly by a partner organization in a developing country overseas and asked whether he can support them negotiate with Save the Children on this subcontractual arrangement. And to give you a flavor of the kind of things they gave as feedback, they said the contract is disproportionately complicated, legalistic, and lengthy relative to the size of the grant, which was $10,000 to $20,000, inappropriate for local people who'd benefit greatly from the plain use of English documentation. The contract conditions were regarded as unreasonable. Past attempts to negotiate those have been unsuccessful. For example, copyright materials produced by the partner vest in Save the Children, even though we're just one and the smallest of several funders. Shortly after the contract was signed, we delivered two boxes of papers to the partner for signing and insisted that they sign every page in duplicate, 488 pages of contract. And we've insisted they participate in training on the annexures, even though the policies remain largely unchanged from previous years. They're broadly aligned to the partner's own policies. The size of the grant's very small, and we're one of the smallest funders. So extraordinary, right? That for a contract at $10,000 or $20,000, we're wrapping this small local partner organization in Southeast Asia in these reams of paperwork, bureaucratic, complicated, legalistic documentation. Guess who the back donor was? It was DFAT. Surprise, surprise. And as it turns out, Save the Children Australia wasn't even directly involved in this. We'd passed it on as a direct received opportunity because it was below our usual thresholds of getting engaged. So whilst there was no sort of egg on my face as Save the Children Australia, nonetheless, it was our Save the Children country office in this country passing on these obligations from the back donor DFAT, but also taking a completely inflexible approach in how to support that partner, meet them. So extraordinary, right? Flip side, best case study, during COVID, we were approached at one point in time by a foundation representing a very high net worth individual who had seen us talk about some cash transfer programming work we'd done in Fiji. They came to us and said, we know Fiji's struggling during COVID. The economy has shut down overnight when the borders closed because it's, you know, 50, 60% of the economy relies on tourism. do you think you could do some work in social protection and cash programming in that instance? And we said, yeah, we definitely could. We've got a mobile money platform we can use. We've trialed it. It works quite well. We've got some local partners we can work with. Do you think you could do something about $5 or $6 million US? And they said, we thought you'd ask for more. How about $20 million US? And from there, it was the most beautiful relationship. There was trust. They understood that we know what we're doing. We've done this sort of thing before. They didn't require us to reinvent the wheel. They said, whatever reports you would normally produce, just produce those. We'll be happy. If we've got further questions, we will ask you to. We're sure you're going to evaluate this as you normally would. Can you share that, the results of the evaluation with us, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very symbiotic and efficient relationship from there forward. And the results were extraordinary. You know, when I went to Fiji a little bit later, I was stopped in the street by people saying, were you part of Save the Children? That cash transfer literally saved my livelihood during COVID because I lost my 20-year job with Fiji Airways or something like that. So, you know, there was trust there. There was an understanding of whose role was what. And we got on and got the job done.
That certainly is a pretty big spectrum of worst to best case scenario. Matt, in your Intel piece, you do talk a lot about trust, but then you also go on to basically argue that both governments, so DFAT in particular, I think you're aiming your sights at here, as well as delivery partners such as SAVE, but also others, really both parties need to step up their game if Australian development is going to deliver on its aspirations. Now, Matt, our editors had a little bit of fun deciding whether or not we would let you describe government's actions as butt covering or not. We said yes in the end. But before we get to that, can you just back up a second? Because for our listeners who don't work in an implementation relationship with DFAT, can you just explain a little about what it's like the second you win a contract to deliver a development program? What happens and just how important is this relationship with DFAT?
There's two ways this might come about if you're an NGO, for example. One is you go through a very long and comprehensive accreditation process, which takes a huge amount of organizational effort to satisfy DFAT in this case that you meet the minimum requirements from a compliance and regulatory perspective. Same would go for every other donor, be it the Green Climate Fund or Global Partnership for Education, etc. There's a sort of minimum set of standards which are expected, and then you either pre-qualify for or bid on work through tender and win it through a NGO activation or a commercial tender opportunity. And then the real sort of devil in the detail starts around setting expectations through program designs, milestone payments, evaluation criteria, audits, all those kind of things that you need to work through. So it is very much a commercial sort of relationship at that point in the typical sense. You know, I used to be a lawyer. Both parties are protecting their own legal and fiduciary interests in this sense, but also hopefully keeping their eye on the prize, which is at the end of the day, we're trying to create impact, in our case for children, through this donor-funded opportunity. I went to the word trust. That was the first word that sprang to mind in what's most important, because I think ultimately that's what it comes down to. And sometimes there is, from both sides, I think, a level of distrust. And I think from a donor perspective, often there's a perception that NGOs aren't as sophisticated or capable as commercial delivery partners. And I really contest that, because Save the Children, for example, we're in 120 countries around the world and we're operating in some of the highest risk places on earth, Gaza right now, Sudan, Myanmar, Afghanistan, Papua New Guinea for that matter. And we're doing it at scale quite often. And we have to have very sophisticated control measures, risk mitigation in place in order to deliver. And I've got to satisfy my own board of those things. At the end of the day, there are directors, very sophisticated professionals who are directors of our company, who have legal and fiduciary obligations to us that need to be met in order for us to deliver in that context. So I find that sometimes frustrating, that there seems to be a sense that, in our case, NGOs aren't as sophisticated, but in other cases, government is very willing to hand over a check to UN agencies, maybe commercial contractors, without that sentiment seeming to apply. So from my perspective, donors need to trust more the capability of NGOs to deliver and to manage risk. From the NGO side, we don't always cover ourselves in glory on this. So sometimes we don't, and NGOs vary in their scale and sophistication, of course. We don't always put our best foot forward in terms of how we are putting controls in place, how we're managing risk, the level of sophistication we bring to the table in our operational capability. Sometimes we overpromise on results in terms of volume or outcomes we're going to deliver, and in terms of timing. And then we came back sort of cap in hand saying we want a no-cost extension because, you know, surprise, surprise, it was hard to deliver on time in a place like PNG, whereas, you know, we've got to get better at that. We should know and factor in to our timelines, expect the unexpected, plan for that, and be quite ruthless and rigorous in sticking to the plan where we can. So I just think we need to do more and be better at that as well.
That was one of the things that I noticed in your Intel response. You didn't slip into advocacy land. You didn't just level criticism at government. You did ask some pretty big questions of NGOs as well. For the government side, you described government as more interested in butt covering than in delivering effective results. And when it came to delivery partners, you went further than this, saying that there really needed to be a good dose of reality in the management of development organisations. Where do you see the opportunity and the way forward here?
Yeah, and I think it does come both ways here. And I think often in NGO world, at least, there is a, I described it as a failure to understand the political economy of aid. And that is that at the end of the day, donors are providing money not just for an altruistic reason, but also for often a strategic security, bilateral relationship, a return on those things. And that's just the way of the world. And we need to accept that and understand that and expect that donors want something in return for their money. It's not just purely to create impact in developing countries, although hopefully that's a really big part of it. And I believe it is too. So we need to be more pragmatic, more realistic about those kind of things. And I think donors need to move beyond the reaction that I think they often have, which is the easiest way to mitigate risk is just to write a check for the UN agency in this situation, because there won't be a huge amount of accountability back to us, and therefore it won't create the political risk with the Australian public. Now, I get that risk. I've worked in politics and I understand why people may be wary of that. But I think there's a real lost opportunity there, because the thing that NGOs who have an Australian presence offer is the ability to really communicate impact back to the Australian audience and say, we are delivering this proudly as an Australian associated organisation with Australian taxpayer money. And we can shout from the rooftops about that and promote that work back to this country and say, we should be proud of the difference we're making in Afghanistan or Myanmar or Papua New Guinea, because it's important work. We have the capability to deliver through our global networks and local partners, and we are delivering results.
Well, Matt, we are reaching the end of our time, but before you go, I am going to ask you to tackle our lab hypothetical. So picture this, you find yourself standing in the elevator next to the Minister for International Development, and he turns to you and asks, "Rightio, all you NGOs, quit your whinging. What is the one reform my government should make to unleash the potential of the NGO sector as a development delivery partner?" Matt, what would you say?
I think the simplest thing he could do would be double the humanitarian fund that exists right now, for example. This is at $150 million Australian at the moment. It is completely inadequate to meet the humanitarian needs that exist globally right now. NGOs are one of the most trusted delivery partners in a humanitarian context, and they should be. And they should double that fund and earmark a huge chunk of it to NGOs who are delivering in the toughest places in the world to survive. And that in itself would be a demonstration of the faith the government has in our capability. And we'd return that in spades by demonstrating back to the public the value add and the impact that Aussie dollars are having on the ground.
Matt, good to see your advocacy stripes coming through with a budget ask at the end. Thank you. It has been great to have you on The Readout.
Great to be with you. Thanks, buddy.
Join me next time on The Readout, where each episode we sit down with one author, one big idea, and talk about how it can shape the future of Australia's development assistance. If you liked hearing from Matt about the secret to a successful donor-implementer relationship, then you can find a link to his Intel piece in our show notes. And if you want extra previews, insights, and development analysis, then sign up to our email at devintelligencelab.com. Special thanks to the lab team behind the scenes, that's Ruby Solwick and Walter Kolnagy. Our music is by Viljami Meto. I'm Bridie Rice. This is The Readout. Talk soon.
We at The Lab acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which this podcast is recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and we extend our respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We're inspired by the storytelling tradition of the world's oldest living culture, and we pay homage to it when we share our stories or intelligence on this podcast.